Thank you, guys. Welcome to .NET Conf. I'm here today with Miguel de Caza and Mads Torgerson. Yeah. And we're here to talk about .NET.
That's right.
Yes, so I'll start, and then we'll have Miguel come out, and then Mads come out. We're going to show a bunch of mobile, a bunch of C#, and a bunch of .NET. So let's get going.
Take it away.
Okay, first off, we got to talk about how we're doing, how the tech's doing. And so we just shipped .NET Core 1.0 June of last year. We're super excited to say that in only less than a year, most loved framework, number 3, not bad for less than a year. C#, one of the most popular languages and growing. Very happy about that. If I look at things like the job market, .NET is the number 2 most requested technology for somebody to know if you're trying to look for a job in computer science. And so we need to make more .NET people. If you think about Microsoft technologies, let's take a look at this chart that I've got here, and it shows after we open source .NET, how we stand against things like Node.js, that little small line at the bottom, and our biggest competitor, Java. You can see we're doing really, really well, being mentioned on both Reddit and Hacker News. And then, of course, you know, we've been open source for a couple of years now, and super excited to say that, first off, you can see, since we open sourced in right there, boom, half of the contributions to .NET now come from the community, not from us. We've had companies like Samsung embrace .NET because it's an open platform. In October of this year, they're going to ship their Tizen SDK for building applications that run on their televisions, that run on their devices, and their appliances. So everybody has an excuse. If you want a new Samsung TV in January, tell your wife, hey, my TV needs to run .NET. And then, of course, we also have a ton of people in our .NET community. We have this foundation, and we've got people like Red Hat, Samsung, Unity, Google, JetBrains, all in our foundation. So great transition to open source. But let's get in and talk about .NET. This is kind of the most exciting thing to me is if you look at this top bar, you can see all the types of applications you can build with .NET today. You can build Windows applications like WinForms and WPF. You can build Windows 10 apps like UWP. If you're using ASP.NET Core, you can build apps that run on servers, on local premise. We've got great support for mobile with iOS and Android. IoT, we're doing some of that in Azure, and we've got a version of .NET Core that runs on ARM32. Obviously, AI is something we care about. We want to make sure that .NET and AI work well together, and then games and VR with Unity. So you can do all those things with .NET. And what's neat about this is we just, with the release of .NET Core 2, have also introduced something called .NET Standard 2. And this means for all these platforms you see, we have the same set of APIs consistent across all that stuff. I can't think of any other platform where you can build all these types of apps and have the exact same framework sitting below all these things. And of course, we have the same tool chain as well, whether it's Visual Studio, Visual Studio for Mac, Visual Studio Code, or the CLI, you can do all these things. So let's talk about .NET Standard. Sometimes people get confused by this. They come to me and they're like, where do I download it? Where do I install it? And the reality is .NET Standard is not something you install. .NET Standard is actually just a spec. Just like your browser runs HTML5, if you're running Chrome or Firefox or Edge, all those implement HTML5. All we're saying with .NET Standard is all of our .NETs have to implement the list of APIs that we built in .NET Standard to be .NET Standard compliant. And so at this point, I'm happy to announce that pretty much everything in this list supports that. A few weeks ago, we shipped the first previews of .NET Standard 2.0 for UWP applications, and that kind of closes the ring. Every one of these things supports .NET Standard. The next thing is, what is cool about the next version of .NET Standard? We shipped .NET Core in June of last year, and we didn't have time to actually take all the APIs from .NET Framework and shove them into that thing in an open source cross-platform way at that time. But with .NET Standard 2, we've had a chance to go back. We took all the APIs that were in Xamarin and all the APIs that were in .NET Framework that intersected and put those into .NET Standard. That's how we identified what it is. Basically, all the non-UI, all the parts of .NET that actually can run on all platforms. This means that we added about 20,000 APIs with .NET Standard 2. And in our nougat.com or nougat.org package infrastructure, 70% of the packages out there are compliant with .NET Standard 2 today, which means you can use all these old things, and all new things, old things, everything. So I'll show that in a second. This is just a quick highlight of some of the stuff that came back with .NET Standard 2. All the data stuff came back, XML, serialization. So if you tried to move to .NET Core and couldn't, now's the time to try again, because all of this stuff works across all the platforms. So let's do a quick demo of .NET Standard. So I've got a .NET Standard class library here, or a .NET Standard, yes, class library. So let's go here. I'll show you how I built this. There's this new node, .NET Standard, and you select that and build a class library. And that means you want to build a class library that works across all the different types of .NETs. So I've got one here. And I was looking on the web to go and crack open a zip file. And I found this sharp-zip-lib example here with an extract thing. And so I want to use that. So let me go back to Visual Studio. And I'll quickly jump in here. And I'll do Manage NuGet Packages. And let's browse and add one here. So let's type sharp, zip-lib. There we go. And let me try to add that. Oh, there was a failure. Oh, no. What's going on there? So let's look. So if I look at this error, what I'm going to find is this is trying to find .NET 2. Man, I don't have .NET 2. But my app is .NET Standard compliant, and so it probably should support that, even though sharp-zip-lib was actually written in like 2012. So let's go take our library. I cheated. I made this a .NET Standard 1.0 library. Let me move that to 2.0. Yeah. So let me move that to 2.0. Make sure we're healthy here. Okay. And now if I go back to NuGet, I should be able to install that package. Getting further. Success. So now I took this library from 2012. Didn't have to recompile anything. It just works. But I'm looking over here. There's something funny here. If I look in my Solution Explorer, I get these errors, or these warning errors. So what are those? So if I look at my error list, it says basically this package was restored with the version of .NET that I have, and it's not 100% sure that this is going to work. So we're going to let you install anything you want, and if the APIs exist, it'll work. But how do I check if the APIs exist? Well, I can right-click over here, and I can go to this Analyze Project Portability. It's going to run a test. I'm going to open that report. And look here. It says everything is compliant. Perfect. So I know I'm good to go. If you want to download this tool is available right here. This is the .NET Portability Analyzer. And we'll have a link to this in the deck. So we're going to make the deck available afterwards. So you'll be able to come back and find this code. But now that I've done that, man, I don't like this error. So what I'm going to do is find my NuGet package here. I'm going to click Properties. And I'm going to say, hey, I've already checked this thing out. I know it's good. So let's take that error, 1701, put it over here. And if I recompile, warning's all gone because I know I'm good, so all the errors are gone. We're good to go. I want to show one final thing here, which is something else we tried to do with .NET Standard libraries, is make it very easy for customers to build their own NuGet packages. And so you might want to build a package and then share that package with your colleagues in your office. Or you might want to upload it to NuGet.org and share it with more people. There's now a package node over here in the properties for the project. And I can just give this a name, author. So I'll give it a, let's call this, my company, cool zip stuff. Save that. Check this box up here. It says generate a NuGet package on build. And so I'll just rebuild now. Actually, I need to save that first. Save that, do a rebuild. And as soon as I do that, I will have a NuGet package. So super easy to build NuGet packages that are very compliant and standard across all the .NETs. There's my NuGet package. Boom, right there. So never easier to do this with .NET. So that's .NET Standard. Let's jump back and talk about some more features in .NET Core 2.0. We shipped a new CLI, a new SDK with .NET Core 2.0. And First off, one of the biggest complaints customers gave me around .NET Framework was, man, I want more than one of these on the machine at the same time. And today we only have like version 2 and version 4 on the box. We don't put more on because it ships with Windows, and Windows doesn't want to have to get huge. They want to stay small. So with .NET Core, we leave that choice up to you. You can install as many SDKs side by side and many frameworks side by side as you want. So we support multiple SDKs. Another thing is we're trying to make the CLI be able to do everything that Visual Studio can do. So any action you can do in Visual Studio, you should be able to do in the CLI. So we've added all the project templates from VS into the CLI. And we've added support for VB and quite a few of these templates in the 2.0 wave. And we've added commands to the CLI for dealing with solutions and projects and a bunch of stuff, because I never want you to have to edit the CSproj file if you don't want to. You should have commands to do that. So let's take a quick look at that. So I'll jump over here. Before we look at that, let's look at the machine here real quick. I'm going to go to my C drive. I'll go to Program Files. And the way .NET Core is installed in your machine, there's a folder called .NET. There's no registry. There's no System32. Everything that's required to run .NET sits in this particular folder. And if I look in here, you can see I've got three versions of the framework. I've got a 105, a 112, and a 2.0. These can all be side by side. I said that's one of the benefits of .NET Core. But I also have multiple SDKs. You can see I've got a 110 SDK and a 2.0 SDK. You might ask, how do I control these things? So we offer a great way to do that as well. So what I've got here is I've got, let's go to my drive here. We'll go and create a folder, make dir console app here. And if I type .NET dash dash version, you're going to see that I am running the 2.0 framework here. Now, what if I want to use 1.1 instead? I want to use the other SDK because I have old projects that I want to keep running the way they are today. I can easily do that as well. So all I've got to do is let's jump back out to my source folder. We'll go into the console application. And I've got a file sitting on my desktop called global.json. And you can put some settings in here. So I'll grab that file, paste it into here. And we can load up VS Code over here. Give it a second. And there's my global JSON. And you're going to see inside this global JSON, I actually can set the version of the SDK that I want to use. If I change that to 1.1 and save it and go back to the console here, .NET version is now going to say 1.1. So I could easily move back and forth between these two SDKs. So if you have old projects, drop one of these files in a folder, and you're good to go. Now let's switch back to 2.0, because that's what I want to use. There we go. And let's just check. Good, we're back on 2.0. And I'm going to say .NET new. And we're going to see when I do that, all these new project templates I was just talking about. You can see here I've got console apps, class libraries, unit tests, a whole ton of ASP.NETs. NuGet, web configs, Razor files, pretty much all the things you want to build in .NET are all sitting right here. And you can see, language-wise, if you're a VB person out there and been waiting for VB support with .NET Core, you can see some of that coming in now. So let's go .NET, new console. There we go. Now, one of the things I mentioned before, we want to make all the things you can do in Visual Studio actually work here as well. So I can now do add reference. I can do .NET add reference. And I can go back and grab that class library we just had earlier. I could easily edit the CSproj file by hand, but I don't have to. I can actually just go and do stuff like this. What if I want to make this something you could open in Visual Studio as well, other than like VS Code? I can do .NET add solution file. Did I mess up here? Actually, .NET new SLN. Then I can, once I have that solution, I can say .NET SLN add the console project to it. And because I'm actually referencing that other class library, maybe I want to add that as well. And so I can just go back as simple as So now I've actually got a project. You can see I've got a solution file here. I've got my project file. I'm basically able to build all the same things I could do in Visual Studio right here in VS Code in the editor. I can do one last thing here. Since I referenced that project, I can probably do something like using, let's go back and see our code. Oops. Jump over here to our project, jump into the code. Oh, I never wrote any code here. Let's go put some code over here. I was just talking about the zip sample here. Let's grab the code from this. Grab that. Stick that over here. Grab this function here. Stick it in here. There we go. And I'll probably make this class called, rename it to be unzip. And I'll make this static. I don't want to have to instantiate the class to actually use this. We got a few things we have to go fix here. VS will help me with that. Boom. Took some code from 2012, built a class library. I'm good to go. Now I should be able to go back to VS Code. And I'll say yes. I had the missing stuff. And I should be able to just come over here and do things like using. It knows about standard class library. It already saw that. I can come down here and do, let's do standard class library dot unzip. Oh, class one. I rename that. Come on, IntelliSense, don't fail me now. This will be unzip, extract file. And I've got a couple of files on the disk here. So what I'm going to do is stick these out. And let's go back to the File Explorer. I've got a sample folder here with a sample file here. Grab that. Images.zip. It's going to want an at sign over here to make it happy. I'll do a null. And we'll grab that folder again. And at this point, I've got a class library using .NET Standard 2, all built, hung together here with VS Code. And it just shows that workflow, which is pretty cool. So let's jump back over to the slides here and move on. .NET Core 2, what's the big stuff in .NET Core 2? We added a bunch more APIs, all those APIs from .NET Standard 2. A bunch of new project templates. If you're a web developer, we've got Angular and a bunch of other ones in there as well. React. We support more Linux distros than we ever have, and we'll keep adding more. We have simplified packaging. .NET Core 1, we actually required you to actually install a package for each parts of ASP.NET and a package for each of the parts of .NET Core. We've simplified these things in .NET Core 2, where you just reference .NET Core, and you reference ASP.NET in two lines, and I'll show that in a sample in a second here. Much better tooling support for the CSproj and .NET Core and .NET Standard in the update of VS 2017 that just shipped, and we've got the same support for VS for Mac as well. Next, ASP.NET Core 2. This is 20% faster in the Tech Empower benchmark. That's our primary benchmark we go after than ASP.NET Core 1.0. So we've continued this push to have high performance. We've added a new framework called Razor Pages, and it's for if you're a developer, and sometimes MVC is a great pattern, but having to have a folder with your code, a folder with your view, and some weird conventions is kind of complicated. You just want to get stuff done, and so we've got a simple framework called Razor Pages that lets you go a lot faster. We've added support for Razor for C# 7.1. Mads is going to come talk about C# a little bit later on. One of the coolest things we've done, if you're publishing your app up, it used to be in the old days, that every time you published, you would publish all the ASP.NET assemblies. And if I go back and look at my C drive and go up to .NET, let's go back in here real quick. One thing, I've got the shared SDK, which is right here, and it's something megs. But we did something new with this version of .NET, and I now have a folder in here called store. And what store is basically a place for us to put all the stuff that we don't want your machine to have to pull down when you build applications, and you don't have to publish when you publish to something like Azure. And so we stuck all the ASP.NET stuff in here. Because of that, when I publish an app now, it's 2 megs versus 16 megs. Really, all you're doing in a publish now is you're publishing your application and nothing else. We've added great support for Azure Diagnostics and Live Analytics. You can actually take an ASP.NET Core application, put it onto Azure, and all the diagnostic stuff is hooked up, and I'll show some of that later on. If you're building apps that do authentication, we've added support for authenticator apps. I'm sure we all have them on our phones, and we use them to log into stuff. That's now built into ASP.NET Core 2. So let's do a quick demo of ASP.NET Core 2 now. Okay, so I'll jump out of here. And we'll go to web, and I'll click ASP.NET Core 2. And you'll notice here I've got a few new options. Mentioned them before. Here is my Razor web application. Here's my traditional MVC. You can see I've got my Angular here, and I've got two Reacts. So we've got some new templates for everybody. I'm going to create one of these Razor apps. So this is a Razor page app. Give it a second to create. After it creates, I'll quickly jump into the CS proj file. I want to show you what I was talking about earlier. If I come over here and I look at the CS proj, you're going to notice that it references .NET Core and it references ASP.NET. And that really is one of our big goals, was not to have, you know, I want you to be able to type this stuff by hand. You can't remember 30 packages or how many packages it was before. So it's much simpler. Now let's look at one of these things. So I've just got a folder on my app now called Pages. And inside of Pages, I just have Pages. If I reference contact.css, just contact, my app slash contact, it'll actually run the contact page. This tech is all built on top of MVC. So even though it's a simpler form of MVC, you can actually mix MVC apps or MVC pages and Razor pages in a single app. So if you've got pages you want to do really simply, write them with Razor pages. If you have existing code, you can use your MVC views. So I can actually add a Razor page here. We'll call this test. Save that. And I'll show you how this thing works here. So I've got, added a class, not a page. There we go. Go back. So we'll call this test. That looks like a page. So let me jump over here. Here's my pages. Open that. And I want to show something really quick. I'm just going to go and jump to the CSHTML file behind here. So unlike MVC, this one has the code file sitting in the same folder right behind the page. And I could go add something new in here. I can add a class in here. Let's do something simple. Let's do a string. I'll call it date. And down here, we can just do something like on my onGet, this is the method called before the page is viewed. I can see date equals date time dot now dot to time string. Let's do that. Now, what's cool, if I go back to my page and I'm in here, I can say at model. Anything that I put in there is actually added to the model for the page. So I get IntelliSense, there's my date. So it's simple to build a page that's going to run. It's just going to show the date. And then I'll show you, after this runs, I'll show you how to build something a little bit more complicated. Let's go here. There's my page. Here's my test page. It shows the date. Nothing crazy. Let's go build a form real quick. So the first thing, if I want to build a form, I probably want some data. So let me create a model folder here. Go up here. Add a new folder. We'll call it models. And inside the model folder, let me create a brand new class library, class here. We'll call this customer. And what I'll do here is I've got, should have a snippet here. There you go. All this class is a two strings. And I put some attributes on here. I want to have client-side validation and server-side validation requiring people to actually fill these fields in. I can control dot here, bring that namespace in. Now I've got a model. So let's go back to our test page here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a form here. So I built one of those as well. There we go. And I'll just quickly talk through what this is. So this is, it's going to complain right now because I haven't added stuff to my model. But if you look at this code, it's regular HTML code. I've just got a form tag up there with a post. I've got some divs with a special ASP-validation summary. That makes that div become a special place where validation errors would go for us. I've got a regular HTML label tag here, but I can actually put these ASP4s in, and that makes some magic happen here where I can basically give it the model and the view, the part of the model that I want. My input tag has one of these as well. So you can see I've got a first name and a last name, and I've got a button. So it's pretty simple. I've got these errors because I need to fix a few things. First off, it was looking for a message type here and that customer. So what I'm going to do here, remember before, if I want to add things to my model, I just put them right here in the class. So I can say I've got a message here. And let's add another one here. I'll add models.customer, and I'll call that customer. So I've got these two properties now. That should make the compilers all happy in a second here. Yep, all happy. Now let's think about this. I want this customer data to be bound to those labels and to those input tags. And so to do that, I need to put an attribute on this class telling ASP.NET to bind this. So I'm going to say bind property. I want it to bind this property to those elements in that form. And for this message I'm going to store whether we succeeded or failed in this message. And I want that to persist across the page. To do that, I need to put that in something called temp data. And that means that we'll actually, ASP.NET will grab this field and persist it across request. And we got one more quick thing to do here is what I'll do is I need to create a on, let's do this. I need an on post, so when the submit button's pressed, this will be called. And because I'm doing data binding, the object will already be set there. I'm going to change this to be an action result because I'm going to return something from this. And then I would just write typical MVC style code here. So I could do something like if not model state is valid. So basically I'm saying, hey, if you filled in all the fields, you did not fill in all the fields, I want to show the error message. So I would just say return page. And then if you're successful, I would say so like save data here. And then finally, after I save the data, I would probably do something like, what would I do? First off, let's save the data. I'll cheat here and just say return page real quick. Save the data. So before I run this, what I want to do is I want to point out that this is using the same tech as MVC. So I'm not going to save that data, but I want to be able to show it in the output of the application. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a constructor here as well. So let's go up to here after the before the onGet. Oops. And let's add a constructor. There's my model. And I can say MVC has this feature called logger factories and logging. So I can just add an iLogger factory here. So I want to show this is real MVC. It all works exactly like it does. Let's do that. Let's have it bring a namespace in for me. There you go. So this is dependency injected into the page. And I could have an iLogger right here. And what I want to do here is basically say logger equals logger factory with the right case. If I can type right here. Logger factory. And I'm going to create a logger, and I'm just going to give it my type here. And that's going to be a test model. There we go. And so this gives me an instance of a logger that I can use to actually log stuff. So I can now come down here, and where I was going to save the data, I can just do something like logger dot let's log something like an error. It's not going to be an error, but I want to show up when I show, I'm going to publish this to Azure, and I want this to show up in the portal. So then I would do something like added user, and I can use customer dot first name, comma, customer dot last name. There we go. Make sure we got a semicolon there. And then finally, I probably want to do down here, I probably want to do some kind of redirect. So let's do redirect. Redirect to page. And normally I would say like index, but in this case, let's just go back to the same page anyways because we're not going to save the actual data. And I want to show a message here as well. So I could say message, that's that field I put there, equals success. So at this point, I'm good. I've got a fully running Razor Page app. So let's run this and see what happens. Okay, so go to the test page here. If I just press submit, there's my validation working. I can put my name in here. Success, I'm good to go. So let's get this up in the cloud. So this, that's how easy it is to write a Razor Page app. But it can be a little bit cooler, so let's put this in the cloud. I'm going to right-click over here and do a publish. We'll select App Service. And we'll call this .NET Conf CSH Web. And we'll put this in, we're in West Europe, so let's put this in West Europe. It's still actually thinking up there, so it might move me around. It just did. It's really trying not to let me do that. Okay, there we go. So we're in West Europe, the data center closest to here, and we'll create this and publish this. While this is going on, I'm going to jump out and go through some slides, and we'll jump back to this in just a quick second. Next thing is, I want to announce something else. It's not shipping today, but we're working on something called the Windows Compatibility Pack for .NET Core. With .NET Standard 2, we added a ton of extra APIs, but we plan to add even more. These are not going to be in .NET Standard because they're not. Some of these APIs are not things that actually can be cross-platform across all the different platforms, but we know there's customers trying to move apps to .NET Core that might be held back by some missing things. And so I've got a few of these on the screen here. We've got Win32 Registry is one of these things. We have System Code DOM, System Configuration, Configuration Manager, Drawing's a big one that people ask us, Runtime Caching, and many more. This will be a NuGet package you can install on your .NET Core apps to get even more compatibility. This is going to talk about what I'm going to jump back to the portal for a second for. With VS 2017, we've added a lot more Azure features, Azure functions. If you want serverless computing, that is, you don't want to pay to have your app running all the time. You only want to pay for it when it's actually called. You can write an Azure function in C#. It's only pay for when it's called. We've added great CI/CD support. I can actually take an app, put it in source control, and we will actually build it in the cloud for you, all for free, using the CI/CD support. There's a wizard inside of Visual Studio. You go through it, and your app goes up to either App Service, Service Fabric, or App Service Linux. Azure Diagnostics, that's what I'm going to show next. A big piece of this is how you get your app to the cloud. How do you actually debug it and deal with those kinds of things? And so we added a bunch of cool work for that. This slide shows a little bit of it. I can take an app, see my app running in the cloud, see errors in it. We'll install a profiler, and we'll look for common errors. If there's a common exception, we'll actually freeze the process for a second, take a snapshot, put it on disk, And then you can actually open that in Visual Studio later on and see all the errors of the detail, just like you were live debugging the application. And another big thing here is this is supporting what we call our architecture page. This is dot.net/architecture. You can go here, and we've got books on microservices and containers with .NET. We've got books on mobile, if you want to build mobile apps, and we have cloud and web here as well. These are PDF or view on web with best practices, and there's a sample app with each of these as well, showing you all these best practices. So let's jump back over and see where we landed here. So here is my app running up in Azure, and let's go to the portal and try something here real quick. So I'm going to jump over here, and let's go find the app. Let's go look at app services. And one of the cool things we did with this round of ASP.NET is it's aware of Azure, and Azure's aware of it. So a lot of folks, when I tell them this, they don't even recognize this. But I can come down here, and there's this diagnostic features inside of Azure, diagnostic logs. I'm just going to turn that on, and I'm going to set that to the error level, and I'm going to press save. Now, what's cool here is I didn't have to go add any diagnostics to my application. I didn't have to add a NuGet package or republish. I just turn it on. I can go to the log stream now. This log stream can be viewed both inside of Visual Studio and inside the portal. It's connected. Let's go back to our app. And if you remember, I actually added logging to that app when I when it succeeds. It's supposed to write to the logs. So success, go back here. You can see that wrote right to the logs. So Razor Page app, yeah, thank you. So the cool thing is this stuff just works. I can go back up to diagnostics logs. If I wanted to, I could do something crazy like, let's turn it on to verbose. We added tons of logging inside of ASP.NET in this round of ASP.NET. So if I go back to my app now and click around some of these pages, there'll be tons of stuff in the log stream. Let me actually bring the log stream up, connect, hit a few pages. Tons of data. So it's easy to attach logs. Even better, we have this feature called App Insights. And I'm going to quickly show the App Insights stuff here. Notice I can click a single button to turn App Insights on. It gives you even bigger logging. But let me show you the quick version of that. So I've got, let me close out this Visual Studio. Close that out as well. I'm going to open up a different app. I've got an app that I've already had running in the cloud for a while. I have App Insights turned on. And I want to show you one of the coolest features we have. So it's up running in the cloud with all those diagnostics features turned on already. I don't want to demo it live because you have to actually wait about 3 minutes after you put the app up for the results to start coming in, and I don't have that much time. So I've got the app loaded in Visual Studio. Let's go look at the app in the portal. So I'll go over here, find my app services, and here's my ASP.NET Core snapshots. I just want to quickly show it's real. I'll click the link to go to it. And from here, I will go to the About page, which I actually put an exception in, so it crashes by default. But let's think about it. If I was going to try to diagnose that problem, what would I do? I'm going to go to App Insights. And I'm going to go to the big view. This is a quick view showing me a little bit of data, but I want all the data. So I'm going to go to the big view. And there's a new view here called an app map. And that's going to show me all the pieces of my app. You can see some of that; those graphs are showing some of my data coming in. And I can see here I've got a bunch of failures here. So let's click this. Here's my top error. It's an exception. I'll show you the error. If I go back to Visual Studio and I look at my home controller, then you see I put an exception here. Throw new exception. The app crashed. I can actually click that in the portal. It's going to show me a lot of details about where the error came from, what country, Sweden, what time, all that kind of stuff. I can open that snapshot, and it's going to show me all the stack but also all the variables, everything that was live in that is available right from the portal. Even better, notice this download feature. I can download that snapshot to Visual Studio. So what does that mean? I've actually pre-downloaded that just for fast demos. Here it is. I'm going to double-click it, and it's going to say, yeah, I know it could be dangerous. We're going to let this open up. And so this is really cool. Your app's crashing. We'll identify it. When it crashes enough times, we'll make a snapshot. You can then download that file, and then you can see exactly what this looks like in Visual Studio. Take a look at this. It looks like my app just crashed. I'm on the line that crashed. I've got my exception, just like you would see if you're running it locally in Visual Studio, and everything on the stack is right here. Is that not cool? Thank you. Okay, and that's just a brief part of that feature. We have another part of this feature called Snap Points, where you can actually go put breakpoints directly in directly from Visual Studio in your running app in the cloud, and we'll take the snapshots when those snapshots are actually hit. I'm actually running out of time, but I was going to show one final thing. That CI/CD is as simple as pulling this down and saying configure continuous delivery. You bring this up, a dialog comes up, you press go, and within 30 seconds, you have CI/CD set up either to app service containers, or service fabric. With that said, I'm going to bring Miguel out and let him talk about mobile.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's an honor and a privilege to be talking to you today. We're here in Sweden. So mobile is an incredibly exciting space. Now there's billions of devices running this thing, and we've been lucky enough that we can run .NET on these platforms. The commitment of my team, the team that is building .NET for mobile, is that everything that you can do with the native platforms on Android, iOS, tvOS, or watchOS should be possible to be done with .NET. But also, the other part of our commitment is that we should bring all the capabilities that you love from .NET to this world. So we're blending these two worlds together. So I'm going to give you today a little bit of a taste of the things that we're doing and some of the new things that we're thinking about and how we can make your life easier and make you a happier mobile developer. As you know, the fall is the season where we folks that work on mobile say it's the update season, right? Both Google and Apple release major updates to their operating system. Apple is pretty consistent, and Google has a bigger range of update times. But Android Oreo just came out, and fear not, we got your back. Everything in Android Oreo is now supported by the Xamarin platform and .NET, and all of the capabilities that are so exciting about the platform are there. Apple is launching, I believe it's today, I'm confused about the time zones, but I think it must be around now, that they're launching iOS 11, and fear not, everything new in iOS 11 is present. There's all kinds of new things. For example, CoreML is a framework for doing machine learning, and Microsoft itself is shipping a Xamarin-based application that has migrated from its own neural network to Apple's CoreML. And another theme that sort of developed in the last, I would say, 6 months is this passion for AR. So let me tell you a little bit about this. So about 2 years ago, we started a work on this project on porting an open source library called Urho to .NET. And we made it very easy for developers to create 3D content and spice up their existing mobile apps with some 3D. This works on all of our supported platforms, Windows, Mac, Android, iOS, and everything in between. And one of the things that we ended up doing is we supported HoloLens. And turns out that was a little bit of ahead of our time, because now that AR Core and AR Kit are public for Android and iOS, you can build your AR applications with C# and Visual Studio and F#. So there's a session later that will go into more detail about this, but we're very excited about this. Now, as you know, my team is also responsible for Visual Studio for Mac. And the idea behind this is we wanted to have a full development experience on the Mac where you could not only build your mobile application, a lot of developers use the Mac for building their mobile applications, but also to maintain and develop their server-side components, right, the backend that you're talking to. So this year at the Build conference, we launched Visual Studio for Mac. It's a .NET-centric IDE. We're focused on C# and F#, and anything that you need to build ASP.NET applications, so HTML, JS, and all of these things. And of course, we have a close affiliation with the Azure platform. Now, I want to do a demo today. I want to show you something. It's a preview feature, and we will show you where we think we're going with mobile development. So if we could switch, please, to my Mac. So let me tell you what's going on here. On the left side, I have Visual Studio, and on the right side, I have a connection to my phone. This is my personal phone, so I hope you know, I don't get some messages here while I'm doing this. In the traditional way that you develop mobile applications, you typically would modify your code, and then you would hit run, it would compile, it will deploy either on device or simulator, and you would run the application. And this is the usual workflow. You edit, compile, deploy, run, right? And you do this thing, and you debug. But we thought, there's a desire now of getting a little bit of the feeling of developing a web page where you type a little code, you save, you reload, and it automatically does it. So let me show you what we're going to do today. I'm going to launch the Xamarin player, and I'm going to pair this little guy here. Oh, let me just get this thing. Let me see if I can pair this thing. I'm going to repair. I'm going to disconnect this one. And I'm going to pair it like this. All right. I hope this demo works. Like I said, this is a preview feature. But the idea is that usually you do this development where you run and build. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start my application. And actually, they keep it. Oh, no, that's not what I want. No. Not that. Let's remove that typo here. OK. And let me connect it to the live player. And this is the capability. You select one of your views in your application, and you're going to live run it. And what that does is that any code changes that I make to the code happen automatically without saving. So I'll show you. You see that label that says basic A0. This is an app that I'm building so I can easily upgrade my Azure machine. So I'm going to just press one key. Watch. And it updated. There was no saving. I didn't use two fingers. Yes. But we can do better than this, right? So for example, this thing just looks absolutely terrible. These run and upgrade buttons, I don't know who did it. It's a border width of 3. I did it. So I'm going to change that to 1. So that looks a little bit more elegant. In fact, I can probably resize this a little bit more so it looks a little bit better. OK. And then I'm going to, this is a native API here, an iOS native API. So I'm going to say button.layer.cornerRadius. And I'm going to set it to maybe 10. And off it goes. OK, that's a little bit too much. Let's change that to 3. OK, that's better. Now, the other thing I want to do is when I click on the upgrade button, I want to upgrade my machine. So I'm going to make a web service call. Now, I don't have time to actually make a web service call. So we're just going to pretend. So pretend along with me. I'm going to make it so that when you press the upgrade button, it actually upgrades your VM, right? So I'm going to define a handler. You guys are very familiar with this API. And now I could just do something like fake it and say, now I got a standard A8, and that's going to set me back a couple $1,000s per week. So so when I press this button, upgrade, boom, look at that. But we can do a little bit better than that. We can also do an animation. So I can say animate for 1 second. And this is what I'm going to animate. So it's going to execute this code to animate. So I'm going to do, you see this little cute image? So I'm going to say, well, the image frame, it's actually going to be, I have it hard-coded, so forgive me about this. But I'm going to say, just change this thing to be bigger. So when I press upgrade, look what happens. And again, every time I type the code, it gets recompiled and re-executed. That's the flashing that you see on the screen. So when I press upgrade, look at that beautiful thing. Did you see that? That was amazing. Now, of course, there's a bug here. I don't know if you noticed that. It's kind of an obnoxious bug, so let me just do this. You'll see that when I press upgrade, standard A8 happens immediately. I think it should happen at the end. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put this on the second delegate. So I'm only going to update the text when that happens. So now when I press upgrade, my VM, beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. It's a thing of beauty. All right. Well, so this is one thing that we're doing. And the nice thing about this capability is that you can do this either is that you don't, I don't know if you noticed, but I connected this over Wi-Fi. So you don't actually need to do this from a Mac. You can also do it from Visual Studio on Windows. So this is very, very convenient. And as you can see, the loop for developing is very, very fast. So let's go back to my slides now. And let's talk about a little bit about what the technology that we have. So essentially, one of the big wins of using .NET for developing mobile applications is that you can share a lot of C# code, either code that you wrote or code that you're getting from NuGet packages, right? So a third-party component. And then you build a native UI, just like the one that I built right now. As you saw, those funky APIs, for those of you that are not familiar, those are native iOS APIs, right? All of that, cgrect, UIView, they're all native APIs. And you would build, essentially, you would share your code, and then you have a UI for iOS, Android, and Windows. Now, we've also created this thing called Xamarin Forms. And Xamarin Forms gives you an abstraction layer where you say, hey, give me a button. And we take care of creating a UI button on iOS, a button widget on Android, and a UWP one. And it's been very popular. And as you can see, our users are very happy with it, as shown on the diagram. Now, there's a lot of work that we've been doing here. So Forms started mostly as a technology for building business applications. But now it has grown to the point where you can build really polished consumer applications. So a lot of our focus for the past year has been to polish the technology, to make it better, and to support all the things that you needed. We also worked a lot on performance. So for those of you using Android, you'll be very happy to know that we improved the performance tremendously by using a technology called layout compression. We're also adding support for our brothers and sisters in the Middle East that like to write things the other way around. So instead of left to right, they do right to left. And we have full support for that and accessibility for those of you that want to make your application accessible. We're also migrating to the .NET standard this fall, so you'll get it soon. Now, a lot of you are familiar with our trilogy. We did Android, iOS, and UWP. And any good trilogy, there's a lot of fan fiction out there and prequels. So today, I'm happy to announce that we have a couple of interesting prequels for you. This abstraction layer now also supports Linux, macOS, and WPF. So now you can use one single code base to target all these platforms. And our fan fiction would be Tizen and Unity. You can also target these two platforms with a single API. So now it's thank you. So a universal UI standard, if you will. All right, let me tell you about another thing. In the past, you also had to make a choice. Should I build a native app? Should I build a Forms app? Now you don't have to make that choice. You can mix and match as much as you want. We're also delivering that in October, in a couple of weeks or next week, something like that. But it's about to come out. So you no longer have to choose. You can take your existing app and add some forms, or you can take a Forms app and use some native code. Well, that was always possible. It's the other way that wasn't possible. So we're adding that support. Now, the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about today is the following. Just along the lines of this theme of sharing is that we are very fortunate as .NET developers. We're very fortunate because we have a fantastic language called C# and F#. They've led the innovation in many areas. Async came out of here. Iterators came out of here. Dynamic programming, generics, and they're just fantastic. But not everybody's as lucky, right? We also have a fabulous runtime, high performance, highly tuned, a great ecosystem of NuGet packages. And we as .NET developers are incredibly fortunate to have this for us. But not everybody's so fortunate. Some people are using primitive languages, legacy languages, or your boss at work might say, hey, listen, I know you're good with .NET, but we just somebody's going to maintain this piece of old legacy code that we have in the company. So. And I thought that I'm on a humanitarian mission here to help you all, right? We need to bring joy to these communities, and some people go through rough times. So we launched the Embeddinator 4000. And I really like the name because I think that the name describes exactly what it is, and I don't need to tell you what it is, so I'm just gonna go straight to the demo. No, I'm kidding. What Embeddinator 4000 does is it takes your .NET code, right? It takes your .NET code, it can be business logic or it can be UI code, and it will turn it into a native library. And it can be a native library for the target platform, and it can also surface API bindings on the target language. So for example, we can take a .NET library and surface it as an Android jar package, right? An AIR, or we can generate an Android jar package for the desktop, or we can generate a library on macOS that surfaces an Objective-C API on macOS, iOS, and tvOS. Or you can target Linux, and you can get bindings for C or C++. It depends. So we support both generating frameworks for different platforms and generating different languages. So it is an open source effort, and we hope to add more languages to the mix. But essentially, now you can bring, you can continue building .NET code and bring it over there. So I want to show you how this works real quick here on my Mac. I'm going to close this project here, and I'm going to open the don't save. And I'm going to open this other one, and I'll just give you a taste of what it is. But here, my friend James Montemagno built a little web service called the Exam Weather Fetcher, and it has a very simple API, a constructor here for the city and state. It makes a web request, it parses the result, right? But additionally, he's built a native iOS view that would show this on the UI. So when you build this thing, and in fact, I'm not going to build it because it takes a little while to package it. And you know what? I'm going to build it because I do have a couple of minutes. So this is running the Embeddingator, and the Embeddingator right now is generating Java APIs, Mac APIs, and iOS APIs. So you'll see it, it's a little bit ugly, but we'll get to that. So as you can see, this is generating a native library. This is an iOS native .a library. And it is going to be packaged. I'm going to switch real quick to my terminal. Where's my terminal? I have a lot of this. I'm going to switch to the big one. All right, that's not the big one. OK, this is completed. This is completed, and this needle is building. This one has to do ARM, ARM64, ARMv7. So it's building a lot of different libraries for you. Let me just go here, Embeddingator. And I hope that you can see this. But what this just did, you can see it here. It generated the iOS output. Right, and it generates a beautiful dot framework package that iOS consumes. So you can just drag and drop this weather framework, and it has the headers, right, with the native API, right. So let me show you what that looks like. This is what it looks like. Oh, that's not the right one. Bindings? Is this one? Yes, there it is. So it generated here a beautiful macOS API. So those of you that are familiar with macOS will know that this is here you declare the same object. So you consume an Objective-C API here. But not only that, but we also generated a beautiful API for the view, right? So we have this weather view. So that application that was a C# UI view, native UI view, that subclass and native UI view, now is re-exposed back to Objective-C. So everything that you can do with the native languages, you can do it here, but sharing all of your code. I think I have a couple more minutes. Yes or no? Okay, so let me launch my Xcode. As you can see, I don't have the latest, but I have the GM, which is good enough. And let me go here, and let me do File, Open Recent, My Weather. And this is a native project built in Objective-C, right? And this little guy, where's this little guy? The view controller, it's here, right here. So this is calling the API. So this is an Objective-C application that is calling the API. And you can see here that it's referencing the framework. I don't know how to zoom in here. So for those of you watching this, you're just going to have to believe me. But this is referencing the library that I just created. And when I run it, and I'm going to run it, maybe I'm going to run it in a simulator, but it might be a little bit faster. Well, let's see what happens here. I'm going to run the simulator. Which one is a good one? iPhone 5S. All right, this is going to take a while. All right, there it goes. OK, we're going to have to wait for this to boot, so I'm taking questions now. All right, you're just going to have to believe me. There it is. I run the wrong thing. Anyways. There it is. So city, what is my city? Boston, Massachusetts, get weather. So this is the UI view, right? So this is the UI view that we just embedded. So it's 65. I don't speak Fahrenheit, so I assume that's good. we're burning. But that's it. So I hope you enjoy the show. There's a lot more this week, and I hope to see you be very happy with .NET and mobile.
All right, let's change gears a little bit and talk about Visual Studio and about C#. So that was the Embeddingator, and this is something else in Ader, the Codingator or something. You know, we shipped Visual Studio 2017 back in March or so. I don't want to say spring, because it's actually fall in Australia. We focused a lot on, you know, productivity and performance there, and you saw an amazing number of things come in that were very code-focused. So there was just core performance work, make sure you didn't have to wait as long for things, including like an install experience that was completely revamped, letting you only get the things you need. Huge improvements to navigation in your code, IntelliSense, lots of refactorings, lots of quick fixes, lots of things at your fingertips, like a control dot away that would let you do things inside of your code that usually you had to kind of roam the menus for and switch screens and whatnot. So there's a lot of focus on that. We introduced, sort of as an extension of that, we introduced this whole new notion of code style as something that's supported in the tool where you can specify your preferences about how your code should look. Like, is it var or is it explicit types? I'm not answering the question yet, I'm just saying, you can choose. And lots of things about naming and so on that you can actually specify somewhere central, and the tool is gonna hold you to it. It's gonna tell you when you deviate, and it's gonna give you fixes to get back in line, right? And then, of course, there was live unit testing, which was this awesome thing that would run your unit tests as you were coding and tell you what was currently passing, which lines were covered by which tests, and were they actually good or were they bad. So that was a really strong release, I think, and it was important for us in the update 15.3, which shipped together with .NET Standard 2.0 and .NET Core 2.0 about a month ago. It was important that we kind of build on those things and make sure that we keep pushing on that angle. So we did a lot of different things here again. Project files, we kept doing work to make them simpler and simpler. You have to say a lot less now in a project file, you have globbing and so on. And also that they're portable between the different tools, including the CLI that you saw before. So also more navigation work, more IntelliSense work. Live unit testing, importantly, now works with .NET Core. It didn't in the beginning, but obviously that's going to be a very important thing. More diagnostics that are live, telling you about things that aren't traditionally part of the tool. We ship those as analyzers. So we've gotten into the business of writing a lot of what we call analyzers, Roslyn analyzers, that will tell you about whether you're following API guidelines, sort of FXCOP style. In fact, our goal is to replace FXCOP with live analyzers. So instead of getting a report at the end, once you build, you know, you get that feedback as you're coding. So that's the essence of Visual Studio 2017 update 15.3. And that's the kind of thing that I'm going to show you now because, no, hang on a second. There was one more thing. We also shipped a version of C# 7, and it wasn't a major version. So it's a major thing that we're shipping a minor version of C#, because we haven't done that like forever. And this is sort of part of the idea that we don't actually, there's no big reason why we wait 2-3 years between versions of C#. If we have something cool, why not ship it? If we have a theme that's cross-cutting between tools, frameworks, runtime, and language, why not be able to ship language features along with that theme? So we actually went and did our first little point release, and the point of this point release primarily just is to kind of grease the skids and feel out what does it feel like to have a point release. So there's some really minor features in here that I hope you enjoy. Okay, so now it's demo time. I'll go to my demo machine, and what you see here is a little project. I have a person class, because person classes are apparently in these days. I have live unit testing running on it. There's a program that does something with it, like a console app. There's a very advanced database kind of framework here that is optimized for demo. And I have some unit tests. So important thing, notice first, live unit testing. This is a .NET Core project. So now you're not limited to traditional .NET framework, but you can do this for .NET Core projects as well. So very useful. Another important thing, with the live unit testing is one of the sort of bottlenecks around it is that it does an analysis to make sure that you are, or to kind of map out which tests cover which lines of your production code, right? So that analysis takes time. That's part of the reason why we haven't been starting up live unit testing automatically when you open a project, because it adds to that time that you have to wait before you're up and running. But we went and made changes so that we actually persist the result of that analysis, put it in a file on disk, and whenever you stop and start live unit testing, instead of computing it all over, we just refresh it from disk, right? So you can see here, it's kind of cheating because it's a small project, but if we go and stop it, it goes away immediately, that's no surprise, but you come and you start it again, and boom, immediately you get the icons, and of course it takes a little time for the actual tests to run, but immediately it knows which lines are covered by which tests. So that's really useful and actually enables us, if we go and look at the settings here for live unit testing, it enables us to add an option. We haven't made it on by default yet, but maybe we will, an option to just start live unit testing on load, because if that stuff sits there in a file, that doesn't really add much overhead to the startup time, and so you're able to opt into that as well. So that's a little bit about live unit testing. Now, let's talk about some of the, just show a few of those code fixes and things that we added as well. So some of them, as I said, are part of the tool. Some of them are part of analyzers that we offer as extensions that you can just go and install as Visual Studio extensions. So I'm going to show some of both. If we let's start out by actually fixing the bug that's causing these unit tests to fail. I didn't just have the bug so you could see that there were red crosses as well. I actually want to fix it. And so let's look at what's failing here. It looks like the tests are about first name and last name and the behavior around when they're being null. And indeed, the intention here is that the middle name should be allowed to be null because not everybody has one, but the first name and last name should always be there. And so we kind of forgot to add a test for that in our constructor. So let's go and see. There's now a new fix to add a null check. You can, when the type is string, you can additionally choose the sort of more advanced checks to see is it empty, is it only white space. We should probably pick one of those, but I'm just going to add the simple null check because it's so cool that it uses the new ability to have throw as an expression that was added in C# 7.0 and the null propagating operator, which is a very neat way of checking for null and throwing an exception if it is null. Okay, so let's do that for the last parameter as well, and hopefully our test will turn green. Yes, okay, all right, so we fixed that one. Now, another one that's interesting, let's go to the advanced database here. You will see that there's a tiny little set of dots on the database here. Can you see the dots? Yes, you're nodding. You can see the dots out there on their screens in the world. You can also see the dots. They're a very discrete hint that is added to Visual Studio to suggest something without kind of saying anything's wrong. It's just sort of like, hey, if you want to do something cool, come on over here. So we sometimes refer to it as the smudge, but I think the official name is the suggestion dots. And what is it suggesting here? It's suggesting that this type is a static holder type, but it is not static and it is not inheritable. What that means is we run afoul of a framework design guideline that says that if it doesn't have any instance stuff in it, it should probably be a static class. And so this is an example of one of the FXCOP rules, not a very interesting one, but it's simple and I can easily show you, that is now a live thing that you can fix along the way if you choose to be in line with these FXCOP rules. So I can easily fix it with a fix that's built in. Okay. A final one that I want to show, this loadPeopleAsync method is async. It's aptly named, it returns a task. And so our guidelines kind of say that you should have a cancellation token, an optional parameter that's a cancellation token. So I'm going to include a cancellation token here. Let's see. It's hard to spell. I wonder, can you help me? I press control dot, and apparently I'm close enough that it finds out what I mean. It suggests a type that's available. Actually, it could even find it if there was a NuGet package that would offer it, and says, is that the one you mean? Do you want me to install that? Do you want me to add a using clause and correct your typo along the way? Oh, yeah, thanks. Cool, man. So that's really nice. But also, watch what happens when I press space now. Ready? There's help for naming. You get naming completion. And it offers some really obvious names, but those are typically the ones that you want, right? And actually, the naming follows your code style settings. So if you opted for having underscores in your names or whatever, camel case, all those things, the suggestions will follow that. So it all kind of comes together. So that's just a little sampling of those tooling things that we offer. And that's sort of what I wanted to show there. But we also have some language features. And let's stay with what we had there in the database, and let's start looking at those. As I said, they were small, but they're really awesome. Okay, so also when I have a cancellation token, it should be an optional parameter, so I need to write a default, which means I have to say, classically, I have to say default, and then a very long type name right after I just type the type name. And that's kind of annoying. So we're letting you have default to a type that is in the context if it's there. We call it target type default, which means that if it's being assigned to or passed to something that clearly has a type, you don't have to say the type again. You can just say keyword default. It's small, but hey, I'll take it, you know? A few more. Let's go to the program. This awesome program here. You know what really sucks is writing a console app that uses something async, right? Because you can't await in the main method yet. So you have to resort to these things where you call, this is the ugly hack that you can find on a blog somewhere. This is what you do to wait for the thing that's really a task. Like load people async returns me a task and I do that. That's not really nice. What I really want to do is I want to await it, okay? I just want to await it. But I can only do that if I'm in an async method. Well, let's make it async. So you can now make, actually it's not so much that main methods can be async, it's that they can now return tasks. There's this little problem that I don't have task included yet, but again, control dot, using system threading.tasks, and you know, everything gets included the way I want it. So a main method with a task, the runner, the running infrastructure will now just wait for that task to be completed before it shuts down your program again. Don't say async void main, because then, you know, it won't run. But async task main lets you just look like any other async method, return a task to the runner, and it will wait nicely, let your whole program run before it actually shuts it down. Okay? So that's kind of a little nice, isn't it? Come on. Thank you. Thanks. I'm only going to beg for that one. Okay. So, final little one here. I have a query here. I query over my persons that I got back from my database, and I'm selecting out a tuple, like you used to maybe use anonymous types for this. You can do that too, but I'm using new tuples, and I'm giving the tuple elements names like you can. But it kind of feels redundant that this thing is called last name, and I still have to call it last name. And so in C# 7.1, we made it so that just like we do for anonymous types, if an expression that you're creating a tuple element from has a name, it sort of ends on a name, we're just going to use that name and name the tuple element for you. So we can just delete this, and the tuple element is still called last name. You can see it down here. We still infer the name last name for that tuple element, and I'm still able to dot into it here as part of the code here. So that was a little selection of things that we added in the language and in the tool. And I think Scott would like to come on stage and talk to the next few slides. Thank you.
Tap on the door. Miguel. Who's your slides? So obviously, you just shipped .NET Core in VS 2017 15.3. Download this stuff today if you've not already. I hope you've already downloaded it. But if not, it's out there, .NET/core or visualstudio.com. Next thing we want to talk about is what are we thinking next? And we have a couple things that Mads is going to show. And if we have time, Miguel's going to have a few things as well. But I want to talk about the overall platform. Big thing that we care about is inner loop. This is how fast when you save something, you can actually refresh your browser and see the results of what you did. So that's an area we're going to focus on. Building smaller standalone apps. .NET Core, the whole goal of .NET Core originally was to have these small apps. And as we added all those APIs with .NET Core 2.0, now we need to make them smaller again. So we're going to introduce a linker to let you link out the parts of .NET that you don't use so you can build small standalone apps. Native is something we still want to look at as well. We have great tech for building native Windows applications. Can we use that same tech to build .NET Core applications? Global tools is anybody in the room has probably already used npm install to install something that you can then run on your app. Like we want to do that same kind of thing with .NET, so you can actually go install a NuGet package and then just be able to use that to add a command to the platform. Machine learning and artificial intelligence. We've got a new section of our website, dot.net. If you go up there. AI, if you scroll about halfway down, there's an AI link with how to use AI with .NET, and that's an area we're investing in. IoT, we have an ARM 30, I mentioned this earlier, we have an ARM 32 version of .NET Core coming out later this year that can run on Raspberry Pis and such. That'll be officially supported. And then getting better diagnostics on Linux. But I want to go through this really fast and let you talk about C#.
Okay. So see, that's why I didn't go off stage, because I actually had some future things to talk about. Let's talk a little bit about where C# is headed next. So we kind of got appetite for these point releases. There's a project going on that's one of those cross-cutting themes that I talked about, which is about essentially having safe, efficient, low-level code. So that's not for everybody, but everybody's going to benefit from it. The idea is today you have to essentially all bets are off. You have to go and write unsafe code if you want to do decent interop or some efficient low-level coding. You're essentially saying, forget all about being safe and just be really careful and do lots of testing, right? So you're sort of in C land. And that's all right, but we want to do better. We've gotten a lot of experience from some internal projects in how we can do better. And we've gone and put those to work across framework, runtime, tooling, and language. And so the idea there is that we let you represent, sort of one of the core concepts at least, just to put a very high-level spin on it, is we let you represent memory segments that might be from native memory or passed across interop boundaries or wherever they're from. And we let you do it safely, where they come with a length so you can't go overboard. They come with special lifetime handling that lies in the language and that makes sure that you don't persist these longer than you sort of are allowed to. They don't sit around in the heap and become stale and point to something else than you thought they did. So that's going to be a really exciting sort of collaborative release across the different stacks, and I look forward to it. Then there's probably going to be a C# 7.3. If there is, it's probably going to be about pattern matching. So we ship a pattern matching as part of C# 7. And there were certainly things that we wanted to also do that we didn't do in the first release, either because we weren't sure how to do them yet or just because we didn't have time. And that seems to be a good kind of catch-up release and get sort of more well-rounded on the pattern matching side. And then we do still have major releases here and there. And I bet that the next one is going to be called C# 8. I'm willing to put money on it, though that's probably forbidden since I am able to influence the decision. Here we're thinking about major features. And this is just a short list. We have a very long list of major features that we're thinking about. If you go to our GitHub site, you can see what's tagged with 8.0. That's sort of the list that we are that's in the running. But I just wanted to talk about a few here. So one is, it's a feature that is sort of gaining popularity, and I have to be honest and say that we're stealing it, but we're putting our own spin on it, and it's going to be really nice, which is the idea that, you know, the problem that it addresses is interfaces can't really evolve, because if you add a new member to an interface, everyone who's currently implementing the interface is going to be broken, right? They don't implement that new member. So in order to break that deadlock, we would allow you to put a default implementation on an interface member. We essentially allow you to put a little bit of code in an interface that can sort of express default behavior, maybe in terms of the other members of that interface. And then when somebody implements it and they do not implement that new member, they just get that default implementation. Okay? So that kind of lets you move the interface forward as long as you tell, as long as you say how people who didn't know about it, how they're going to deal with that new member. And then everybody who implements it after that, they have the choice of still just using the default implementation, but also providing a better one for their specific purposes. There's async streams. We've had async for a couple of releases now. It's really good for distributed programming. But increasingly, we see a need to deal with essentially sequences that are spread out over time, that are asynchronous. They arrive a little bit at a time. Okay? It's very common. You have event streams. You have streams of data that come across the wire. These kinds of things. And so we want to embrace that in the language, where when you have that kind of asynchronous stream, you can for each over it. You can generate a new one with an iterator, things like that. So just like we embraced, promises or tasks in the language with async, and got rid of the callbacks involved with that, we're going to do something similar and sort of allow you not to have to do callback-based programming for streams. And that's also very interesting. But the one I'm going to show you today is nullable reference types. And I'm going to switch to my demo machine for that one. I'm going to stare at it for a bit and hope the light is good here, because it went to the light is not good. Somebody turned on the light. Thank you. There we go. Good one. So I have the same person class that you saw before, but now I'm running it in another Visual Studio where I installed an extension that is actually publicly available, and we're going to make sure that you can get the deck, and the link is in the deck, if you want to go and try it. It's a little rough on the edges. It doesn't work so well with live unit testing yet, so that's why I have it on a separate Visual Studio. But this is a prototype of a feature that we call nullable reference types. Now, null is this thing that is just super integrated in the .NET world, right? Null is at the core of the runtime, and there's no way that we could live in a world without nulls. But it's also the source of the most exceptions by far that people have in production code. So there's a bit of a tension there, and we want to do what we can in the language to try to ease that tension and to actually let you get a grip on your usage of null. It's not that null is bad, it's that, you know, you just have to do it carefully and safely, and we want to help you with that. And the kind of philosophy that we employ here is that you can use null all you want as long as you tell us about it. And what I mean by that, we can kind of see here in the prototype. So looking at the person class, you see there's one little new warning here. And that's a warning saying this null that you're passing for the middle name, for the string here, that one, you can't pass that because ordinary reference types should no longer just accept null. At least they should warn you first. Like, we're essentially pushing null out of the reference types that you're used to and saying, better not do that. Keeping those sort of like a safe space, a null-free space, just gently nudging you away from that. Well, what can I do then? Well, one thing is I can say, there's a new operator in town, we call it the null ignoring operator or something, but it's probably more aptly named the damn it operator. Like, I do what I want, okay? It's not a good solution to the problem. The better solution is to say, hey, I actually have a different intent for the middle name than I have for the first and the last name. I intend for the middle name to sometimes be null, so let's give it a nullable type, okay? Let's put a question mark on there. So that's a new syntax there. So, okay, I said that. Now I can't assign that to the actual property, so let's go and make the property nullable as well. And now my public surface area clearly expresses the difference in intent between the different properties. Some are supposed to be null, some are not supposed to be null. And now the consumer can act according to those expectations. And not only can they act, but they will, because we're going to make them. So let's go and make them do that. So here's a little program. It's based on the assumption that I didn't verify that Miguel has no middle name. De is not a middle name. So Miguel has no middle name. So what I'm doing here is I'm creating Miguel, I'm getting the length of his middle name, and then I'm writing it out. And get length of middle name gets the length of the middle name. I now get a squiggle because I am trying to assign the nullable middle name to a non-nullable local variable. Okay. Thank you. What should I do about it? Well, there's plenty of things I can do about it, but what I'm not just going to do is to let it go through and be dereferenced without null checks. So let's make the local variable nullable here, and you see we push the warning around. Now the dot is bad because you can't dot into something that might be null. What can I do about that? Well, maybe you apply the null conditional operator to it, but now I'm returning it. That makes me return a nullable int, and then I have to sort of go and say, oh, and if that result is null, then return zero as well. So that's perfectly, now it's null safe, right? Now we just fix the problem. But the compiler is a little smarter than just this local kind of fixing. Another thing I can do is to fix it with flow analysis. So it's a whole flow analysis, just like with definite assignment, where I can say if middle name is not null, then return the middle name.length. You know, then the warning goes away because the compiler saw that you checked it for null up there and says fine. Then I don't think it's null inside of the branch here. So it does a whole flow analysis there. And now, of course, I have to return something else. I have to say else, I have to return zero otherwise. But another way I can do it is to say if it is equal to null, you know, return zero. And then the flow analysis knows that if you get down there, then it wasn't null, because then we would have returned. And so we're essentially recognizing the ways that you already checked for null. You don't have to write your null checks in new ways in order to defeat this set of warnings. It should recognize your null safe code and leave you be, but if you have a null bug, it's going to warn you. You can fix it. You live a safer life. Maybe we will see null reference exceptions and null argument exceptions no longer be the most popular exceptions in the world, and it'll all be a better place. Thank you very much. And now, I would like to bring Miguel back on stage to talk a little bit about other futures.
Thank you, Matt. Well, that is fantastic. It's been the nullable reference types.
I said you have 3 minutes.
I have 3 minutes. Yeah. I love nullable reference types. All right, I have 3 minutes, so I'm going to go very quickly. So one of the things that we're very excited about is this launch of WebAssembly, which is a new standard for running code on the browser that is not JavaScript. So we've been porting the mono runtime to WebAssembly. Also, Core RT is being ported there. And we have two modes of operation. One of them compiles the mono runtime and runs an interpreter that is used for quickly iterating. Again, big on iteration times. And a release mode where we're going to do the full thing that we do on iOS. We link your program, we compile your program, we generate a nice payload. And part of what we need to do is expose a layer for you to call from .NET into JavaScript and from JavaScript to .NET. Where you can go to this webpage here on the GitHub site, and you'll see the sample code on how to make that happen. So right now we have both bridges working. One of the things that we have not integrated but working on is I'll get to that in a second. So right now this is how it works. From C# you can call JavaScript like this. So we have an API that you can, from C# invoke out into the browser. So when you're running a WebAssembly, you can call back out into the DOM. Now, as a C# developer, this is a little ugly, right? This string interpolation and putting things there, this is just a nightmare. So one of the things that we're working on is surfacing this as a strongly typed API. So the strongly typed API that you love and care about will be surfaced to .NET, C# and F#. And if you want to go on and try this out, take it out for a spin, that is the website. And I am done. That's it.
So myself, Mads, and Miguel all want to say thank you guys very much. And there's a whole 3 days of content in .NET Conf. We have a lot of great speakers. Please enjoy .NET.
Yes, enjoy .NET. I love you very much. Thank you for attending. And there's a lot of sessions.
And C# and F# and VB.
Yeah, enjoy the heck out of it.
So thank you guys.